a cup of coffee yet today, which is no way to be. And I won't get to do it yet for a little bit. I really am pretty dependent upon my cup of coffee. I guess. I mean, I drink it absolutely every day, and I tell myself I need it. I don't know if I actually need it. Presumably, I would not die if I didn't have it. But maybe. But I'm not willing to say that I don't need it.
Yeah, I seem to be the same way myself with that cup of coffee. I try to resist the second. Sometimes on holiday, I'll have a little shot in the afternoon or on a weekend. I try to resist it. The second one is not always good for my nerves, I think.
No, I can't do it. I can't. I really try to only drink one cup a day, and that has been hard for me because I love coffee so much.
Yeah.
But I went a few days without, and it was good for me and reduced my anxiety in a dramatic way about life. And so now I only drink one cup a day, which seems to allow for, I don't know, a manageable amount of anxiety. There's some amount of anxiety that I'm willing to have if I get to drink coffee. And there's an amount of anxiety I'm not willing to have and drink more coffee. Would I be willing to have no coffee if that's what it took to have a manageable amount of anxiety? It's not clear.
And isn't that odd?
Yeah.
It's hard to do the things that I know are going to actually make me spiritually more whole and effective and a better person. And yet, I tend towards these things. It seems to me like fallen nature or the samsaric nature of being leads to a difficulty of doing what is rather easy. That there's a certain ease in leading a spiritual life. It's actually easier than leading a quote-unquote worldly life. Well, that would have to be unpacked, what that means. But and yet, it's easier because of our fallen nature to lead a worldly life, which actually makes life harder. And I find that a strange tension, and to be true for myself.
I have this idea that somehow there's certain ailments make the cure distasteful. And a lot of our life is that, we know what we need. We know what would fix it. And the more that we have of that ailment, the more we don't want. I mean, yoga is a good example, frankly. You know, you don't want to do an injury because you don't want to do yoga because you have back pain. You know, my teacher, my wife, when she started making me do yoga, we'd go do yoga and say, well, I don't know, you know, I've got back pain. And she'd say, I know. Let's go do yoga. And I'd say, yeah, but I have back pain. She'd say, I know. And we'd go do yoga, and I would say, yeah, that was tough. It really kind of hurts, actually. She said, I know. And I said, no, but I mean, it hurts my back. She would say, you know, predictopotamus. I know. Right. And of course, yeah, I know it hurts your back, you know, and right. And doing that and having it hurt my back more, it did eventually make me feel better. And I also, I'm loath to give that advice to people.
Right.
Because it seems insensitive. And you could hurt your back worse doing yoga. That is also possible.
That is possible.
But it's also possible that your back is going to hurt more while you're fixing it.
Yeah, and I do think, I mean, specifically about yoga, which is tangential to what I just brought up, but related, is that I do feel I've done yoga. I did yoga for 20 years with a quote unquote with a bad back, and now don't have one. as, or it comes and goes, or it's just a different level of pain by a long shot. Instead of a 9 out of 10, it's a 2 out of 10. So, yeah. But I do know how to do yoga now inside of the injury and push into those areas without being pushy, or investigate those areas where I would before just kind of try to work through it and bust through it and kind of like almost what's the Nike slow? Oh, just do it. So I'm not a just do it guy anymore. Just do it. No, do it and do it very differently, because this morning you're tender right there. And so, and I'm sure you do this. I mean, you're teaching yoga and you're involved with yoga all the time. I have a daily practice, which is very moderate, but I do sometimes push harder when I'm feeling well. But then when I have little tweaks and things, I don't know, just being very unaggressive in my, when pain comes up, and also taking that tack sort of with the influence of you relative to mental difficulties. When I told you the other day, I was in deep sorrow. We talked and I said, I just hurt my wife. We just got in a fight. We don't fight a lot and we just got in a fight. And it's just that we can't go there right now. I was like that. I was saying that to you. I said, we can't. And she's like, I need, this can't. And I was like, this can't be right now. And yet it was. Yeah. And then you compassionately said, you know, and it's okay, Kev, you slipped up, man. Like, and so does that softness around slippage.
Well, and I, for the record, you know, I mean, what I mean to have said is not just it's okay that you slipped up, but the same circumstance under which you don't have room to get into an argument is exactly the kind of thing that tends
produces.
To lead to, yeah. So it's like, you know, so then that's the preface to, so take it easy, you know,
that is the preface.
It's okay. Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
We wanted to be extra sensitive when we are impatient and insensitive, because, you know, when people are already insensitive, is no time to be insensitive. But good luck, which is, it is, I mean, it's, you know, tangential, it's not tangential, that there's a momentum to ailment. It's natural to be irritable about what's irritable about what's irritable.
Right. And then on top of that, it's difficult to stay sweet with one's daily formal practice, if one has one, spiritual practice, and to prepare, like, it's on right now. You are being pushed to a limit, Kev. You're going to be in situations today. And I did practice the morning, some sort of form of practice is practices, and it was did not think about the day in a practical way. It was fruitful in a certain way and maybe a long-term way, but there's oftentimes I need to specifically be like, look, it's on right now with the family and the pressures. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't, it was good for me to reflect after our mm-hmm. conversation that there really are times when it helps to kind of be like, you know what you're going to be in for this evening, right? With the and I don't think I always, I think there needs to be not just planning around mortgages and money and jobs and where our kids are going to go to school and how we're going to get, but intelligent spiritual planning, which by the way is hard when you're stressed out and under pressure. See, like even having the wherewithal to remember to do that, you know, as opposed to just sit and like just try to forget it all. I'm just going to try to sort of just use this practice to just kind of go into some, not a bypass per se, but just kind of relax and using practice the way you would a shot of whiskey. But no, sometimes like actually it's not that it's actually, right. Yeah. So I think without knowing it subconsciously, I sometimes lean on spiritual practice as a sort of, what's the word? Tranquilizer. It's, you know, and it's not, and it's, I want to say, I mean, maybe you have a different response. Maybe we can use it as such and be aware of it, but it doesn't seem to be ultimately very helpful if one does that. So,
think people do. I mean, I hope to be attentive. You know, that's I think that's almost always the goal of my practice is to be attentive to me, to be attentive to the people around me.
To be
ready for what people need, to hear people, to be available. It's a high bar. I mean, that's not easy for me to do. It's surprisingly uneasy for me to do. And for considering how much of my life I spend trying to be better at it.
Right. And when you say that's the goal, it's easy to I would hope that's sort of a, yeah, and I think I can say yes to that too for myself. Mm-hmm. But when one is in it, it's one thing to set that goal. It's another thing to almost have that as a almost backdrop to everything that we're doing the entire time, mm-hmm. whether we're thinking about it directly or whether it's an indirect, implicit part of our practice. And I don't know to. I think it is easy to fall into a wrong kind of enjoyment of spiritual practice and lose those sights. I find that's possible. And just be enjoying the stretch, enjoying the feeling of the opening. Well, that's good. We know we're not trying to be, just enjoy it. But why?
Yes.
Why do you want your knees and hips to be open? Right. Like, who cares? Like, so you're going to waltz to your death with open hips. Wonderful.
Well, and why do you want to feel good, you know? Like,
why do you want to feel good? Why?
Do with pleasure? Is that too reductive or something? Maybe it's more obvious with pleasure? I don't know. But there's this weird line between what's pleasurable and what's fulfilling. You know, I have this conflict where I think, like, on some level I want to be happy. Everyone wants to be happy, right? Dalai Lama says we're all the same in wanting to get away from pain and to be happy. So it's easy, it feels convenient to say that's like the point of life is somehow happiness, or we could say joy or deep happiness or lasting happiness, lasting joy.
Or fulfillment or...
Well, now that's a different thing though, you see. But when you add fulfillment, it becomes quite different in my mind, because we could have flippant, casual happiness and either it doesn't seem like it's enough because we need something, I don't know, something profound or fulfilling about our lives, or it seems like without the profound, fulfilling experience, we can't have a lasting joy. I'm not sure which, but it seems like just simple, stupid happiness. I still proclaim it as an ideal or as a goal, but it also seems like I want to have things that I can be proud of, that I can say that I've done, that I can say that I've achieved. And that's also important to me on top of just being glad or something.
For me, the question becomes, as I get older, a refining of what it is to be happy. And those things that brought happiness or fleeting happiness are, with God's help, becoming less, to some extent, less a part of my life. So what made me happy in my 20s doesn't make me happy in my 50s. And what is... So I think when the Dalai Lama is saying happiness, he's being kind, because I think he's including fulfillment in that, frankly. And I think his notion of happiness is very different from mine. And I think he's talking about ultimate fulfillment and enlightenment. Mm-hmm. I really do. Mm-hmm. And I think he's putting it in a way that he starts most of his talks that way, it seems, mm-hmm. or a lot of them when I've read books or transcriptions. And it's a really beautiful way to bring everyone together. Sometimes it puts people off, like happiness. I'm looking for depth and meaning, man. Happiness. Right. What is that? Right. You know, and you get some responses like that, which fair enough. I never felt that response. I was like, I want to be happy. Cool. Like, totally. I mean, that was always my response. But then, and then I wonder to what extent do these little pleasures that we give ourselves, a glass of wine or whatever it is, can that be a part of making us better listeners, more attentive, and more attentive to our own needs and the needs of others? And I don't think we need to preclude that. Like it is not. It's not, or disclude. What's the word?
That's the one.
Yeah, that's the one. I don't think so. And I think you would agree with that. However, I do think that as we mature spiritually, that some of the lesser pleasures drop away because we're going for something a little bit more lasting. I do think that's a part. Mm-hmm. I do think that happens. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also like this, the difference in attraction to gross pleasure versus subtle pleasure, and how profound, deep, subtle pleasure can be. I think of, I don't know, like we had these greens that we used to grow in our backyard in retreat, and the desert sun makes them extra spicy and lovely. And kind folk taking care of us would bring us these organic collard greens as often as we wanted, basically, you know, or every 2 weeks or something. But the stuff from the garden, I mean, it was just, you couldn't believe it. So like, am I going to put cheese sauce on that? I really like cheese sauce. Like, don't get me wrong. You know, like cheese sauce is awesome.
A lot of things.
Yeah. Cheese sauce is incredible. You know? I'm a big fan of cheese sauce but I'm not going to put cheese sauce on that because I want to taste all the subtle stuff underneath. So what does that mean? Does that mean that I think that subtle stuff tastes better than cheese sauce? Like, I wouldn't exactly say that, you see? Like, yeah. In a way, the cheese sauce, I don't know, the flavor's so big, you know? It's better because it's more good or something. But then it's not, or else I would put cheese sauce on those greens. There's that subtle pleasure that I get that I seem to want that instead without the cheese sauce, even though I really like me some cheese sauce. Maybe I could have a little bowl of it on the side that I could just have sips from.
Just drink it. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. Just keep that on the side, not touch the, yeah.
Which I did with the salsa last night with my burrito. I just drank a salsa. Just
perfect. Yeah.
Right.
A burrito with salsa shooters.
Yeah. It's like a little shot. Can I just,
yeah. Perfect.
And yeah, for me too. I've been growing collards and chard in the garden, which is new for me, and jalapenos, and I'm working on my home and not working for money in the world, which is incredible joy. And it's just so lovely to just go and grab a collard green right from the garden after a rain. And it's just, you wouldn't dream of dipping it in hummus or right. It's yeah, just, right. You know, like, ooh. Goodness, it just, wow. And then what you talked about, just the growing of the greens under the stress of the desert and all the kinds of flavors that come out from that, just wow. And it really bursts upon the tongue. And that's a great joy, you know. And I do think those small pleasures help with a life of contemplation.
Are they better? You see, is the taste of the collard by itself better than the cheese sauce?
Well, it's better in this way to me.
Okay.
It makes my mind clearer and more receptive to the grace of God. And that's just straight up. I overeat, I eat too much cheese, too much dairy, too much meat, and I don't sense God working in my heart, in my life, period. And I know it. There is a direct correlation between light eating and feeling the workings of grace and the Spirit, the Holy Spirit working within me. And I know it. And so you're damn right, it's better. So, yes. And for me, that's just, now that doesn't mean that I don't eat cheese sauce, but I certainly don't eat cheese sauce or cheeses like I used to. I don't. I am begging for the grace to have control.
You no longer have cheese sauce plumbed into the house.
I do have, but I have a big block of cheese in the Airbnb I'm sitting in right now in the little fridge. And I'm really looking forward to having that before I have a burrito that's going to have cheese on it tonight. So.
And I don't want to, and I'm not looking to contradict you. And you sound like you have the makings of like the next great like foodie cult leader. right? Because many have come before you, but it's time for another one, you know? But I'm not asking that yet because that's not why I put the the cheese sauce on the collar. I want to taste there's a similar thing in coffee where there's this like natural processed coffee or washed coffee, and this no one's, you know, in the world, you know, seven people in the world, you know, and me give a shit about this conversation, but like the natural processed coffee, it's good, it tastes really loud and amazing, but then there are those of us who've cultivated our palate and we can taste the varietal in a way that is hard to taste if when it's naturally processed. When it's washed, you can really taste the bean and and where it came from and how it was, you know, what exactly was grown and where, and I like that. It is pulling something away. That's true, to make room for something else, but there's something about the subtlety. And I think there's something like that about descriptions of like the form and formless realm. Or something that when you get into the subtle experience of the sensation of the breath passing in and out of the tip of your nose, when you really learn, when you really see all of the subtle nuanced sensations that go on with a breath that is long and fine at the tip of the nose, that it's so sweet, that it's so badass, that now that's your junk. You see, now you've progressed down from cheese sauce to, you know, raw collards to the sensation of the breath at the tip of the nose. And
yeah,
and now that's your jam. And I think that on one level, yeah, okay, that's just a new addiction, right? And of course, Buddhism is very firm that like that is the next addiction and the point is not that new sensation.
Well, and then to an awareness perhaps of God's will. Or the deepest will towards truth. You've gone from cheese to collards to the sensation in the nose to the subtle workings in the mind and heart, and then to, gosh, what might be a higher thing to do, like in enjoying it immensely. I mean, doesn't, when you talk about the subtleties of coffee, though you're one in seven in the world that cares, I get very excited about it because it seems to be a metaphor for what you just went to form and formless realms. It seems to be like we could use the realm of the senses as a springboard into being subtle, more subtle in the, frankly, the invisible realms or at least invisible to me thus far.
Sure. And, well, that's because you put milk in your coffee.
That's right. I do. Much to your like, dude, why? No, why are you rude? By the way, I did recently brew a pot of coffee and I put the heat on very low. So it took four times as long to get the espresso to go through the machine. And it was so much better. And it was so worth the wait. It changed the taste of the coffee. It's so strange. Like it was a different cup of coffee on low heat versus high heat, which I'm sure you already know about, but it was a discovery for me. So I was thinking of you and I thought I wanted to tell you. I was like,
So, you know, this is right. I mean, this is what makes it on one level, right? I'm saying it's an invisible thing to you because of the milk in your coffee, but I suspect it's similar, right? Like the sensation of the breath at the tip of the nose.
is yeah. invisible, but it's right there. I mean, you did drink coffee today. Like, it's not that, like, you covered that same ground.
Oh, I didn't mean the breath in the nose is invisible, because it's in the realm of the senses. We're still in the natural realm, so to speak. I didn't mean that. I meant more, when I meant invisible, like the workings of the Holy Spirit, I would say is an invisible, or Holy Spirit or divinity.
Is it possible that it's just invisible because of some sort of cheese sauce that you have on it? I mean, it's there. It's present. It's not what I think you're pointing to, or mean to be pointing to. I think you would say is ever present and available.
Five senses cannot perceive it. The eye, nor ear, no smell, no touch.
So after the formless realm, they say the next addiction is the pleasant mental sensation of meditation that becomes the next addiction.
Yep.
So that's okay. It could still, I don't know that we've transcended categories altogether by saying that this is something that's yet a level subtler. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
That it's not just more subtle and more profound. And
right.
Wow. I don't know. And I don't know. And right.
And maybe that would be infinitely so the case, perhaps, mm-hmm. but always. And maybe if there is such a place as heaven or such a realm that there's infinite heavens, infinitely. My instinct is that might not be the case, but, it seems that there's a way in which there's some kind of knowledge that dawns where there, but I've said the opposite at times, even on one of our talks before. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, and there's this tradition that the definition of a bodhisattva is one who never gets tired of more proofs of emptiness. And I don't know. I mean, that's highly commentarial, but
that is, yeah.
But and I suspect that the reason or the idea is that they are excited about serving others and the way that knowledge can serve beings.
Right. And what do you mean when you say emptiness? What do you mean?
Well, in this case, what I'm thinking is that there's something about the infinite regress of trying to put your finger on something like what is most subtle, that the mind can settle on one level of subtlety mm-hmm. or another level of subtlety or another level of subtlety, but to reach for a most subtle, a final level of that is, I would say impossible. I was going to say a fool's errand, but I guess the point is that I'm making is that maybe it's not a fool's errand, that there's something about not being able to put your finger on a finality, but the effort, right? Like reaching into something just smaller and then reaching into something just smaller than that and reaching into something just smaller than that. That does tickle something.
Yeah. Where do you then place, Ben, a notion that natural effort alone, the natural effort we make as practitioners needs the support of grace. Where do you put,
I'm not sure. How is grace not natural in effort? Or what's the difference between natural effort and grace?
I think, well, see, this gets down to such a profound difference in our worldviews. There is a profound difference in our worldviews, I believe, but maybe there's not, that we do not reach, let's say it, a completely fulfilled, contemplative, enlightened, heavenly life, both here and in the hereafter, if there is such a place, through our natural efforts alone.
And what are natural efforts?
I mean God doing the work in us and mm-hmm. our work, like the work of yoga, the work of meditation, the work of practicing virtue.
There Which one is, some, is natural effort?
All of those things are natural effort. Human virtues, things become, there is something beyond my own. My life is held in being by life, it's by love itself, by God. There is a way in which by relinquishing or realizing the limits of human effort and in prayer calling upon grace. When I think of grace or I think of those actions, that's not something, contemplation, living a life where you sense that everything that is holy. Your whole life turns holy. The baptism into your own death so that you can live a risen life in Christ, to use a Christian, that can't happen through our own efforts alone, through what is naturally available to us, eating well, sleeping well, doing yoga, taking care of others, all the things that we can do, praying. There's a sense in which we have to attune ourselves to something that is quite beyond me, it's supernatural. There's hope and there's supernatural hope. There's faith and there's supernatural faith. There's charity and there's supernatural charity. There's compassion and there's supernatural compassion, transcendent compassion. And that comes through, that's a gift.
I don't understand why you would call it other than natural.
I'm getting that. Yeah.
Yeah.
What could be more natural? Is it a gift?
Is it always there? Is it omnipresent? Is it always there? Are you made of it? Do you come from it? What else is it given?
Is it that given nature? It's a gift.
Traditionally, that's what natural might mean, though, right? To have a natural talent or to have a natural tendency, right? Like, we use this terminology to speak of what naturally arises in us. Usually we use the word natural at attention with the word effort, right? So, and that's why when you said the word natural effort, right, it seemed surprising to me.
Not in the Christian mystical context at all. It's the opposite. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not saying that the fact that the world is, we are held in being by God, right? And if God was to stop loving us, we wouldn't be. Like, we're being created in every instant by pure love. And if that was retracted, we wouldn't be. So now there's something in which, of course, that's natural. But
yeah,
what I'm speaking of is that our quote unquote human natural efforts, what is open to the senses, it's a part of disposing us to what is supernatural, what is given from without, what is given as a gift from without. We can go to a certain place through our own efforts. What is not that way?
Like, what is not given from without? Like, what can I truly, today I didn't have
so much coffee and I ate lightly, and by my kind, what in Christianity we call natural effort, I created a some kind of modicum of peace. Is this the peace of beatitude or enlightenment or the contemplative life where I'm aware of God and the holiness within me and without all? No, it's stuff I did. Now, was it grace and a combination of grace and effort that made me drink less? Oh, sure.
Right.
But I'm making a distinction between that and the gift of an awake, a holy, totally awake, aware, risen life that cannot be attained by my own efforts alone.
I understand that you're drawing a distinction in terms of a result, and it's the, uh-huh, uh-huh. the that's easier for me to say you're talking about the difference between feeling a little bit of mental space this afternoon or feeling like I'm in touch with ultimate reality.
Yeah.
But when I go scrutinizing and squeezing what it would mean, right, in terms of the source for one type of effort, for my effort to be natural and something else that I could come into contact with be not natural, is this is where it's confusing to me. Because it seems like it's pretty easy to imagine a description in which even my efforts just sort of happen to me, that I find myself making some effort and it's not clear what chain of events led to me making that slightly better decision today. And we could call it grace. We could call it karma. We could call it conditioning. Something that doesn't seem to be in my direct hands, that seems much bigger than me, that seems on a vast scale, like on the scale of the mechanism of all that is, has provided everything around me and every action that I do and everything that unfolds before my eyes, some of which I some days take credit for and some of which I don't. And it varies from day to day, which of those things, sometimes the same things today I take credit for and tomorrow I don't. It seems real hard for me to know how to draw that distinction and say, but this one is in line with a divine nature and this one is a fallen nature or mere nature, or I'm not sure, you know, what is more, if there is God, okay, and what such a thing as a force
ultimate
from which
source.
We all come and all fall back to and supports us all and by which we could not exist. Boy, does nature seem like a strong contender for ways to describe such a force. God, nature, providence, ultimate reality.
But if we follow our quote-unquote natural proclivities, quite often it seems that we become indecisive and full of torpor and full of something. If we follow our natural proclivities, which is actually easy to do within what Buddha and others have described as a fallen samsaric world, it's all turned upside down. It's all ass backwards. It's like you're doing the thing that you love, and it's actually pushing you further from the Dharma. It's pushing us further from the truth. And it's my mind, my flesh and my appetites do one thing. My mind knows another, and they're at war. There's a war between my natural proclivities and what I know to be true. Help, like deliver me from, and then you really started getting subtle right away, like deliver me from the attachment to the mental pleasure of dwelling in the formless realms. Deliver me from the, and gosh, is there any end to the prayer of deliverance from attachment to more and more subtle forms of pleasure? It's like you went there, and that's like heavy duty. I mean, I haven't even reached the heavy duty meditations of formless realm, so I wouldn't know. But the journey of constantly letting go of a subtler and subtler, grosser to subtler forms of attachment, so that we can truly be alive. It's hard, and it's hard
and
to distinguish.
It's the tradition is also not that somehow you have to taste each of these to understand, but rather that there's something revealed to you in the futility of ever receding levels of subtlety of pleasure.
Right. So you don't go through all those stuff.
That sort of that, right, that transcends that.
Yeah.
You see,
yeah.
that does step beyond, right? And
yeah.
and
yeah.
also that there's some unique pleasure supposed to be associated with
the
wisdom.
That.
Right. The wisdom that arises when we see that there's never going to be any such thing as the most subtle pleasure. And then there's this particularly noted profound pleasure that is said to associate that some people call the most subtle pleasure. Even though that's, you know, maybe exactly wrong, or maybe it's a cute name for it. Still, on the day that I seemingly resist my nature, what led to that, right? What led to that? And for me to point to some place other than, what always causes everything? There was a cause before that. There was a cause before that, and a cause before that, and countless things came together. And it's too big for me to say it was this one thing, or it was this seven things, or here I'll chart it out for you. And that bigness, I think we could mistake for causelessness or something, just because we don't have the capacity to do the math. And it's the mystery of that is profound and sort of divine, that every instant is created anew by more than you could possibly imagine, by more elements that you could possibly imagine. Every piece, part, pixel, bit of anything you could look at in this room is only happening by a miracle of countless. I mean, just the word countless doesn't even seem to do the trick of how many things came together just right, in just the right way, for any smallest bit of the room to be just as it is right now.
Right.
And that seems to be true when I act in line with what we call my nature disparagingly, or
right.
or move into line with what is our natural birthright as divine emanations of the perfect unfolding complexity of the universe.
Yeah, because
I don't know that one is more profound than the other.
I wonder if it's the case that when we awaken to it, I want to say what we're really built for, which is ananda, which is pleasure, satchit ananda. It would be the most natural of. I mean, even Nisargadatta, that guru, he called his yoga the natural yoga. So I like your pushing back against my use, you know. And it's almost like we're having a semantic difficulty, probably more than an actual philosophical difficulty, perhaps, because it does seem like to. Let's for lack of a better word, let's say relative to if we do have something like a true self, what is most natural is to choose that which is most healthy to creating in us, you know, an enlightened way of life. I mean, what could be more natural than that? I mean, and yet here we are doing acts that are frankly unnatural relative to that result constantly. I mean, I'm constantly doing that. Why?
Sure. I mean, is unnatural the state of literally destroying nature as human animals seem want to do?
Right.
Sure. Right. And yet, no, not at all. Or we wouldn't.
Right. 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 And yet, no, not at all. So then, we're, what natural are you talking about, buddy?
Right. Like, is it natural Fermi's paradox? You know, why are there all these lights in the sky, but no? You know, no other minds, maybe they, you know, naturally worlds, destroy themselves.
at a certain level of development, maybe. You know, maybe all right. Natural.
Whoa.
I hope not. You know,
I hope not too.
I'd rather we don't go that way.
Yeah. Cause then that gets into some strange territory.
And we've been on other sides of this debate before. So, right. I'm arguing for what is natural, you know, in something that you've argued was natural on another day.
That is true.
And I, you know, so I find that, you know, in our efforts to push back at one another's worldviews, in a way that allows us to refine our own and each other's worldviews together. I find with it, there's like narrower ledges that we have to like step upon.
It does feel that way. And I didn't mean to declare such a sharp division by saying, look, this is where our worldviews do not touch, because that's too strong, actually. I think that was too strongly stated.
I'm such a contrarian that if you said that we thought the same things, I would surely push back. And if you say that we surely think different things, then I will surely push back.
Bless you for it.
I'm helpless but to do so. It's how I naturally am. And what is so to find something to continue to push back against, you know, it would be something like what is most natural. But to look and say, well, no, maybe, you know, surely what could be more natural than this? And I suspect that we could keep coming up with answers. And there's something about saying, well, this thing's more natural. No, this thing's more natural. No, this thing's more natural. And there's a subtlety in that exercise for me. There's a pleasure in that exercise. I don't claim that this is the highest pleasure. But it is another step subtler that's not physical. And I think... I don't think that we could arrive at a thing that we could call the most natural or the most subtle, right? And that has been called the most natural thing, you see? And and Jetson Kaba, for example, is very careful to say, when I speak of ultimate truth, I am not using the word ultimate in the way that I use it when I talk about whether something ultimately exists, because there is an ultimate truth and nothing ultimately exists. And that adjective doesn't apply to anything for him, but
right. And only that ultimate truth is truly fulfilling.
Except that nothing could ever be truly fulfilling. And he would not,
Right. So therefore, so I'm a piano player. Right. I have a notion of getting to some place on the piano and that some void might be fulfilled. I'm a yoga practice. Mm. I have a notion that getting to some level of yoga, that's gone now. I'm 55. I'll never make it to those levels. Oh, good. I can let go of that illusion. I have a notion that getting to some level of asceticism, I have a notion that getting to some level of intimacy with my wife will fill. I have a notion that maybe if my kids get more this, and if they go this, and they end it, and they're fulfilled. I have those notions. I live in with fear and trembling about. Totally. My God, Ben, what is fulfillment? My God, what do I do? Because, in a way, for you and I, and the game, the trip that we've been on together, the cat's out of the bag. We already know that those things aren't going to fulfill. but I must do something.
Right.
I must act. I want to be more, have a fulfilling life with my wife and have deeper intimacy with her. I want to, of course, these things. And can these things be food so that I don't actually get caught in honestly the realm of the senses? What is it to use the senses properly in an unattached way? What is where I can enjoy the chard in the garden with this clean detachment, without aggression, without violence, without impatience? So we must
and
live.
I don't even know how to speak the relationship between the two. It's so
right,
it's so
right.
slippery, and it's so right revealing again of what is probably broken inside me, in a natural way, but still
broken nonetheless.
I can't help but feel that were I to be in line with this higher truth that allowed me access to fulfillment across whatever I did, that it would still seem to be that there are certain things that Ben likes to do and certain activities that Ben likes to
do yes.
gets fulfillment from, right? Oh, and the yes. relationship oh, between yes. that, right? I mean, it seems apparent. But to articulate the relationship between how it would be that none of those things are the thing doing it.
And yet you're
and
doing
still,
them.
I would yep. be doing all of those things, and they would so... all sort of be the kind of the thing doing it in any given moment, but none of those things would be the thing that was doing it.
Oh, yeah, this is so, thank you for saying. That's that to me, that's the Christian saint, that's the Bodhisattva. You find out that these women and these men who seem to not be hankering for anything worldly are very effective in the world. They design monasteries and get them built. They create, you know, a way of making beer or cheese to keep the whole, these folks who have totally let go seem to be very effective. Are they cheesemakers? Nope, they don't label themselves that way. Are they architects? Nope, but they seem really good at architecture. The enlightened
do they like cheese? Do they like pizza?
But they damn well
they
eat,
like
and
good,
they right. smile when they eat the pizza.
Right. Are they cigar aficionados? Right? No, they wouldn't describe themselves that way. But
no, they wouldn't. But damn, right. if they can't tell what a good whiskey is, right? Uh-huh. I mean, you know, like it's right. really. So then I'm left in this place of where I'm always equivocating. How do I spend?
Right.
Why am I getting good at the piano? For what, Kevin? To what end? Really? To what end? And so I find myself torn, literally to where it's actually, in a sense, made a career for me an impossibility. There's a sense in which, and I say that with a kind of, It's not sad. It's just I'm always looking side glanced at the action, knowing it's not ultimately fulfilling. However, to throw yeah. oneself into one's career in a less attached and sacred way, this I am. So I really truly enjoy architecting.
Yeah, right. It'd be like, you know, less attached and
more involved.
And more involved.
What?
Right. Totally.
What?
More engaged.
What
totally.
The hell is
absolutely
that?
Right.
Like
that
less attached
right.
and more engaged.
Yeah.
Yeah, I own a yoga studio. Am I a yoga studio owner? I am. But
and you can hear the echo yeah. of a thousand voices, you know, come before yeah. who have studied a whisper of emptiness philosophy or something mm-hmm. and said, you know, okay, so the answer is you know, fuck it. Fuck it all. You know, then like, why
right.
do anything?
Yep.
You know, like, why even have this conversation then? I can't tell you how many times someone has said, well, like, yeah, sure.
Oh,
when you get to a certain
I
point of philosophy,
that.
You get to the point where it's like, you know, there's just no point in having the conversation. So you shouldn't think like that, because if you think like that, then there's nothing to think of.
That happens on a weekly basis for me,
of,
by the
course,
way.
Of course.
Oh my God. And it's very frustrating.
Right. And it's natural. and seems deeply incorrect of the sort that the masters of the past, especially Aryanagarjuna, you know, becomes mm-hmm. famous on the tour circuit for talking about, look, you're going to go to one extreme or the other. And, mm-hmm. and to get to that extreme, you need to study philosophy badly. Your natural tendency is to be attracted to thinking that there is ultimate profound value in this activity or the other activity. But then once you learn that that's not true a little bit and study it cursorily or
yes.
badly, then you're going to stop playing piano, you know,
right.
or not sing or say, well, I guess I could do anything. So it could be anything that I find this fulfillment in. So I shouldn't try so hard to do the things that I happen to find fulfillment in now.
And well, and if we're, and then there's, if we're constantly or trying to be attentive to the voice that constantly comes from within and without, to a deeper voice, it may be the fact that your desire to not be in the world when God has put you in the world is a hidden passion and needs right, to be dealt with. But it may be the fact that your desire to be in the world when God is wanting you to be out of the world in a desert, say on a 3-year retreat, like a friend I know has done. That's also, so it's like, see, even that, yeah, there are times, but if you're going to be practicing the piano, well, damn well throw yourself into practicing the piano, my man. Yeah. And then if you're not, well, then you're not. Like, and so I don't always know. I do feel a terrible tension within me. Mm-hmm. And that inability to relieve that tension, it shows me right where I'm at. I feel
I'm,
no...
I'm weary about drawing this line between what is God's will and what is not. And it comes back to this topic that we have discussed before about...
What? You're weary of drawing that line. That line, drawing that line, is the spiritual life.
Yeah,
well, isn't it, Ben? Jeez,
I don't know.
I mean, I'm looking for, like, isn't there? You, so you're saying, is there anything that I can do that isn't God's will? Then if I've done it, if I've gone and done it,
I'm asking that. I'm asking that for sure. Troubling. And it is troubling. And I. Yeah, I think it's an important question. And I don't think that I'd be highly suspicious of anyone who was confident they knew the answer to that question.
And certainly people who have been confident about it have gone into a bunch of mess. So a whole lot of messes have happened because of that confidence.
Yeah. Whole countries, you know, when I think of a relationship with a teacher, when I think of like the holy practice of guru yoga, that I'm not telling people to go run out and do, but I still think is a beautiful thing. And yes, it's gone terribly. And I still think it can be a beautiful thing.
And it's also gone well.
Yeah. It has gone well. And that not though mostly those aren't the incidents that are famous at the moment at this
week. Seems like it. Because the ones that go well, by the way, no one talks about because it's such a hidden secret. The life in Christ in your guru, the life in your guru is so quiet and secret and hidden, and it's a jewel, and it doesn't need to be shared. That's why we don't hear about it. We hear about the disasters.
So, but when we decide that someone is divine, because either we want to see a divine world, either because we have come to the conclusion that there is no real such thing as divinity or lack of divinity, and I will be helpless but to live in the world that I engage with most of the time, or because we come to the conclusion that the world is divine, and we may pick a spot today to practice seeing that truth. To ask yourself in that moment, or even to fantasize that my teacher is an enlightened being, an omniscient being. To fantasize that my teacher is an omniscient being, okay? Now, how would they behave? And to scrutinize their behavior through the lens of, is this what an omniscient being would do? Is this what a being who could see lifetimes into the future would do or not? I haven't the slightest idea, right? I haven't the slightest way of knowing how terribly they would behave if they knew that 73 lifetimes from now, this incredible, wonderful outcome would arise from that. I don't know. Don't let people punch old ladies in the street. Please stop them. You know, do all the normal things. I please everybody that you would do to care for one another. And what is this all? What could this all be building to? What is a good outcome? What is
certainly scrutinizing my inability to know what an omniscient, fully compassionate being would do, and therefore being very self-distrustful and skeptical, such that my 15 years of serving my guru, our teacher, or 10 years I don't know really how to say that because it's on and off, but that whole milieu was so effective because it taught me, it really did teach me, and this is going to sound much more lower level, but it's where I'm at, is to really see the good in others very quickly and try to always feed it. And I just have built, I want to say, I hopefully without pride, I built a habit of just building people up. Like I feel it from you. And I think there is a way in which, sure, there's all kinds of falsity in seeing a being as divine from my side, and all kinds of power in it. And it's a mixed bag. But the overall effect has been to really give people the benefit of the doubt. And by doing so, they seem to just, folks, they behave in a more kind, compassionate way when I'm having those projections, when I'm painting those pictures or assuming that goodness. It's a lovely thing. It seems very upward spiraling to me. It does, yeah. Doesn't it? It seems to function. It seems so. And I'm glad you brought in that rather difficult subject, because it's so related to the worship of God and the worship of Christ and the worship in the monotheistic religions. There's a deep connection.
Divinity of the cross, right? As you speak of the, you know, the symbol and the cross that is not a symbol, and the challenges before us right now and where they are sent from. And if my resistance to step up to challenges is itself not a challenge, then I don't know what the fuck is.
that sort of is the essence of challenge.
Is the cross not divine? Is the cross not given to us? Is the cross not a divine gift? And is my resistance to accept the divine gift not then the divine gift as well? And will my achievements upon that, will the idiosyncratic way in which Ben learns to resist his resistance or learns to transcend his resistance, it, because of the idiosyncratic nature of Ben's resistance, you see, won't it be like such a critical element of the story of my personal path to grace?
Oh. Must want to be silent after that.
Well, that makes for a shitty podcast.
And isn't it true that the closer, as my life goes on and I feel a God recedes and becomes more obscure, the closer I feel to God. And I don't understand. There's a certain way in which symbols, mental abstractions, mental prayer, you know, what we'd say, Jokom or Shargoms or Chegoms, meditations that analyze abstract truths that were used to turn me on so much and create warm, fuzzy, devotional feelings in me. That was helpful, but that's not it either. That's part of it. That's part of coming. And as one gets closer to the mystery of being, it seems to become more obscure to a certain part of my being. Okay, I don't know how to say it. There's an obscurity, and I've used the word in a past talk we've had, a darkness to faith that is very pure like water. It's darkness to a certain aspect of my being that, whereby the things that one might have gone to fill that spiritual void, wanting that devotional feeling, or that it doesn't do it no more. It doesn't provide there's even a sense in which abstract concepts start to be slightly loathsome, in the sense that to dwell in them would push my Lord further away. I don't know. This is somewhat newish territory for me. I'm a little out of my league, but I do feel a sense in which there were practices. You remember when we were told, as we were learning the Buddhist path together for all those years, that it's really, you know, when you're just zinging in a certain practice, you know how it's hard to like leave off your yoga practice or piano practice or whatever you're doing when it's going well. But like Yo-Yo Ma says, like, stop practicing when it's going well. Don't like fizzle out and then leave the piano or your cello. Mm-hmm. And almost with like spiritual practices, like, yeah. And then you feel like, oh, I kind of starting to get this. So, and then I stay there for months and months and months. Dude, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. That's just like cheese on Swiss chard. What are you doing? You're supposed to now let that go. And then I don't always know. I'm like, am I? But it feels like it's still feeding me. No, you're getting spiritually flabby, and it's just, it's emotive and it's emotional, and it gives you this devotional fuzzy wuzzy for a while. There's something else being asked of you by God now. There's something more naked. There's a nakedness of spirit. There's a purity of spirit that can come in if you could just kind of like loosen up your attachment to these symbols or these ideas, because those ideas, which were once portals, are now bars. They were portals, and now they become obstacles. And
I have all of these frustrations around the vernacular of Zen, but the the feel, right, of,
it's funny you should
of
mention that,
standing before utter mystery. You see, of like beginner's mind, right?
Yeah.
That in each moment anew, we are looking at a moment that is wholly anew.
Which you said last podcast. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, not like...
Beautiful.
You know, like we were taught that, you know, this moment has happened countless times, but also this moment has never happened before. And and that, some of the most profound moments in my life were that... Mm. I like the Tao Te Ching is something like, you know, ever desirous, we reach for manifestation, and free from desire, we see the unfolding mystery. And that intimacy with unfolding mystery, with each moment unfolding anew, that excitement about not knowing what is exciting exactly about the next moment, but...
So there's an obscurity built into that, right?
Yeah.
And an odd fulfillment.
It's sexy as hell. It's like the hottest thing. It's like the hottest, deepest, you know, like, you know, bottomless, you know, void.
And D.T. Suzuki's book, that is you read that and he touched something.
Yeah.
Those words, like, that's not just mumbo jumbo. That's something happened to that guy. Like, you know, you feel it in the Zen Mind's Beginner Mind book that it,
stop thinking you know stuff. For God's sake, stop thinking you know stuff, but stop thinking you don't know stuff, as we've said before also. you know, things do come out of that mysterious void and they do take shape and form.
And we interact with them.
It's profound, it's beautiful and lovely and wonderful. And it's... To say that it won't be there tomorrow is to vastly overestimate how long it's stuck around since it already left. And I should go, and I'm grateful for us finding time today.
Amen.
All right, I love you, dude. I'll talk to you soon.
I love you, man.